From the Christian Research Institute in Charlotte, North Carolina, this is the Bible Answer Man broadcast with Hank Hanegraaff. We're on the air because life and truth matter. On today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast, we present an episode of the Hank Unplugged podcast in which Hank talked with philosopher and theologian J.W. Richards, author of The Human Advantage, The Future of American Work in an Age of Smart Machines. Here now is Hank Hanegraaff.
Today, a special treat. I'm going to have a conversation with Dr. J. Richards. He is executive director of the STREAM. He's assistant research professor in the School of Business and Economics at the Catholic University of America and a senior fellow at the Discovery Institute. He has authored so many books that I quite frankly have an addiction to, including a book that I absolutely loved titled Money, Greed, and God. Also, a book that Jay co-authored titled The Privileged Planet. He co-authored this with astronomer Guillermo Gonzalez. And he also co-authored a book with Jonathan Witt, The Hobbit Party. Jay's most recent book is The Human Advantage, The Future of American Work in an Age of Smart Machines. Jay holds a PhD with honors in philosophy and theology from Princeton Theological Seminary. And he's an all-around great guy. Hi, Jay.
Hi, Hank. Great to be with you.
You know, one of the things that I really want to talk to you about today is an article that you wrote. I call it an incredible 12-step program. A 12-step program for those predisposed to uncritically buying into this whole notion of scientific consensus. The title of the article, Politics Disguised as Science, and When to Doubt a Scientific Consensus. And I kind of want to start our conversation with that, going through this 12-step program, because I think this is one of the most important articles I've ever read, particularly in today's climate. And it's a necessary 12-step program for all of us because we are sort of coerced into believing in evolution as a scientific consensus, or climate change, or the myth of the Andalusian paradise, or growing movement towards consensus in the field of artificial intelligence. So I think it's really important for people to get this 12-step program in their minds. And quite frankly, after I saw it, I practically memorized it. I think it's that good. I think it's that important. The first thing that you came up with in terms of when to doubt a scientific consensus is when the consensus claims get bundled together. So you have a whole bunch of claims that get bundled together, and you buy into uncritically wheat that is mixed with chaff.
No, that's right. And that's always the dilemma. I use climate change as the kind of example, essentially, in the article, but it could, as you said, you can apply this to Darwinism, you can apply it to really any intellectual orthodoxy. And people that aren't specialists, I mean, none of us can be specialists in every scientific question, so how do we decide, well, okay, I'm not a specialist, or the ways I can look at this issue and decide whether the consensus that supposedly exists is the result of these people looking at the evidence, or is it groupthink? And I said that the kind of first example of this is when it's an issue that really is about separate questions, but they get bundled together. So with climate change, you've got several different questions. Is it happening, for instance? Is the globe warming, depending on the baseline? Are we causing it? Is it bad or good? That's a relevant question. And then with the policies that we might want to propose, would they make any difference? That is, what to do about it? Those are all separate questions. You might think we're in a warming trend, but say, oh, I don't know what the cause is, and it seems like it's going to be a good thing, and we don't know what the policies are. So when people ask you if you believe in climate change, they're really wanting to know whether you sign on to all of those things, but those are logically distinct. I mean, the polar ice caps could be melting, the polar bears could be drowning. That still wouldn't tell you what the cause of it is or whether any particular policy would make any difference.
We hear so much about CO2 emissions, and it's always in a negative way. We've heard that drumbeat for so long that I suppose people uncritically buy into CO2, got to be bad. Is that necessarily true?
No, not at all. I mean, it's a natural compound. You know, three-atom molecule that is produced when we respire, we breathe in, and Our body takes some oxygen and it passes out some carbon dioxide. And then plants, they effectively breathe in the carbon dioxide and release oxygen. It's an amazingly designed and interconnected system. CO2 isn't a pollutant in the same way that, say, lead or sulfur in the air can be a pollutant. It only gets treated as the bad guy because it's presumed not only that it can contribute to a greenhouse effect, which nobody doubts that. We know that carbon dioxide, you can test this in a lab, can capture infrared radiation. The question is whether the climate's so sensitive that if you just change the CO2 in the atmosphere a little bit, you end up with this cascading event of extreme weather and extreme temperature increase. That's where the debate is. But it's only because we connect it with that idea that anyone imagines that it's, you know, it's somehow a pollutant. But, you know, just in terms of simple chemistry, it's one of these naturally produced compounds in the Earth's atmosphere because of life being here. And it might be good in some cases and bad in other cases, but it shouldn't be treated as if it's a pollutant.
Is there a connection between CO2 emissions and the greening of the planet?
There is, actually. And in fact, you can look at a couple of articles I often talk about that have actually both published in 2010 that looked at what's called the Leaf Area Index. And so you can sort of picture satellites taking pictures of the Earth and then analyzing the change essentially of the color, like, okay, how much leaf area has there been in terms of change? And what we found is that from 1981 until 2010, when these studies were done, we had increased the leaf area index of the planet by about 14%. And most scientists think that's primarily the result of so-called aerial fertilization. So in other words, we know from lots and lots of experiments that if for different plants respond differently, but basically if you increase the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, it's a way of fertilizing the plants. And some plants respond very well to this. And so it's really kind of basic common sense in botany that if we increase the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, that's going to have a positive effect on plant growth. And this is important because this happened at the same time that the, you know, the rainforest in Brazil were shrinking because of humans, you know, tearing stuff down and building farms. So even when you take that into account, we still have about basically 14% more green space since 1981 as a result of this increase in carbon dioxide.
And it seems to me that you also would have a longer growing season. And as a result of that, you'd have more food. There are a lot of people starving. So even that could be considered a good thing.
Absolutely. I mean, even in terms of, you just think about warming, when it's slightly warmer, obviously this is what happened during the medieval warming period 1,000 years ago in Europe. It's when our ancestors, the Vikings, you know, they colonized Iceland and Greenland. Well, the reason they did that is because it was a lot warmer and greener then. We know Northern Europe had better growing seasons. And so that's the reality. If you're going to say, well, is this good or bad? First of all, we need to know whether we're going toward or away from the optimum global temperature, and we don't actually know what that is. But secondly, we know there's at least two effects. Increase in carbon dioxide and at least moderate warming is very likely to be good rather than bad with respect to agriculture.
What's really interesting about this is I mentioned the myth of the Andalusian paradise, and I wrote about that in a book called Muslim, What You Need to Know About the World's Fastest Growing Religion. And I there quote Dario Fernandez Moreira, who talks about why people buy into myths like this or what the motivations are. And he gives a bunch of reasons. And perhaps I've done this actually with him on a podcast, but I think it'd be fun to get your take on it. He talks, for example, about stakeholder interests. And he says that stakeholder interests and incentives affect the research of academics in the humanities no less and perhaps even more than those in the sciences.
That is exactly true. I mean, people will ask me, well, is this just some kind of conspiracy where people are getting together and they know they're lying? So no, you really don't need that to explain it. You can explain almost everything that's happening with climate research in terms of the funding incentives. I have a friend who's a biologist, and her specialty is sea urchins, and she kept trying to get the National Science Foundation to fund her research. They kept turning her down, and she figured out a way to connect her research to the hypothesis of climate change. So she framed it in that way. Guess what happened? She immediately got funded. There is no end to funding resources if you're willing to sort of buy into the intellectual orthodoxy. If, on the other hand, you want to say, well, let's let's compare the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and the temperature across geological time and see what we come up with and treat this as a testable hypothesis, you're likely to be considered a crank. And so that's the problem. There's just that kind of incentive. And so even though you get scientists in the know that will admit, okay, yeah, there's a lot of questions about this, when it comes to the funding, that's just going to govern the way things go. It's not just true climate science. It's true in nutrition science, unfortunately. You get these nutrition organizations that are funded almost entirely by certain food lobbies, and it turns out their research almost always supports whatever the food lobby is. It doesn't mean people are lying. It's just something you call theory-induced blindness, that if you sort of believe the theory and you have every incentive to believe it, that colors your perspective on the evidence, unfortunately.
So I went back to eating eggs in the morning. That's okay.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. In fact, completely forget almost everything you've been told about fat. Don't worry about it.
Don't go away. In just a few moments, we'll rejoin Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with philosopher and theologian J.W. Richards. Are you worried about artificial intelligence? You're not alone. Pop culture pummels us with images of intelligent machines overtaking humans. Transhumanists believe that humans are merely machines and that artificial intelligence is the next step in our evolution. In his new book, The Human Advantage: The Future of American Work in an Age of Smart Machines, Dr. J. Richards dispels these dystopian tales and explains why we should be far more hopeful than fearful about our future due to the human advantage. To receive a copy of The Human Advantage for yourself or as a terrific gift to a friend or loved one, simply call 888-7000-CRI. That's 888-7000-CRI or visit equip.org. The number of wolves surrounding the Christian flock is growing, and they relish nothing more than docile sheep utterly incapable of defending themselves. From militant secularists at home to militant Islamists abroad, the assaults on biblical Christianity are growing dangerously. But Christian Research Institute support team members aren't in favor of feeding these wolves. Instead, each day they're making possible an array of outreaches that defang these wolf packs with solid arguments and evidence that have stood the test of time. What's more, support team members are equipping themselves with CRI's Equipping Essentials, a hand-picked collection of the best apologetics tools around. Your selection of resources, along with a complimentary subscription to the Christian Research Journal, are just our way of saying thanks. To learn more about the benefits of membership, simply visit equip.org. Once again, that's equip.org. The battle for authentic Christianity has never been more intense. That's why Hank Hanegraaff has written a book called The Osteenification of American Christianity. As the title suggests, osteenification is nothing short of the wholesale transformation of American, indeed global, Christianity. It is the prime provocateur of a seductive brand of Christianity that reduces God to a means to our ends and beckons multitudes to the table of the Master, not for the love of the Master, but for what is on the table. You need to defend yourself and those you love against these insidious teachings. Please call today to request The Osteenification of American Christianity. It's our gift to thank you for your donation to support the Christian Research Institute and this Bible Answer Man broadcast. Call 888-7000-CRI or go online to equip.org. Smart machines are reshaping our world and our future. But these machines will never be a substitute for what Dr. J. Richards calls the human advantage. Yet it is critical for the next generation of Christians to understand that in the future, more and more jobs will be done by smart machines, and we must plan accordingly. The new book by Dr. J. Richards, The Human Advantage, will help you understand the increasing threat posed by artificial intelligence and show why the marvelous creation of the human mind and body can never be matched by any machine. To receive your copy of The Human Advantage, The Future of American Work in an Age of Smart Machines, call 888-7000-CRI and make a gift to support the Christian Research Institute's life-changing outreaches.
888-7000-CRI, or visit us online at equip.org. Let's now rejoin Hank Hanegraaff and Dr. Jay Richards in their conversation.
You know, the other thing that Dario Fernandez Moreira talks about is motivated blindness, which inhibits an individual's ability to perceive what he calls inconvenient data.
Absolutely, and that certainly is the case when it comes to climate science. I mean, you know, famous dendrochronologist Michael Mann, he's the guy that became infamous for the so-called hockey stick diagram that played a key role in the UN report in 2001. It purported to show that we were in the process of this really unprecedented exponential increase in temperature. But then when they looked at the data, I mean, he's a dendrochronologist. He's trying to calculate past climate based upon tree rings. That's what the dendro refers to. And of course, tree rings do respond to temperature and things like that. And so he had posited that, in fact, we're in this very unusual warming period. But then when people went back and looked at his data, it turns out he had cherry-picked. So he picked the particular pine trees that fit what he was expecting, and he had some excuse for excluding from the sample every data point in his own data that contradicted it. Now, I don't think he was consciously saying, okay, I need to lie. I think he was just so convinced of the theory. He was looking for evidence for the theory, and so he was able to come up with rationalizations that didn't become obvious to anyone looking at it from the outside, because it's exactly what you don't want to do as a scientist. You want to look at the data set and test your theory against the data set. You don't decide the theory's true ahead of time and then prune the data set to fit the theory. And so as a result, in 2007, the UN dropped that study unceremoniously. Mann is still defending it, but pretty much everyone in the know knows that data was sort of useless.
Something else I ran into really early this morning when I was reading the newspaper, I was reading National Review, and it reminded me of shoddy research by research professors that gets repeated by journalists. And so there's an article, it was by Jack Crow, titled, "Two Researchers Have Been Forced to Issue a Major Correction to a Recent Study Indicating Oceans Have Been Warming at a Significantly Higher Rate Than Previously Thought Due to Climate Change." Interesting, because you get this kind of shoddy research, and then it gets perpetuated in the magazines and the newspapers, et cetera, and it becomes part of the sort of universal consciousness.
It does. I mean, it's like this number everybody's heard, 97% of scientists support catastrophic climate change. Well, you look at the details, and the study doesn't show anything like that. But honestly, it's like the whole population has that 97% number burned in the neural pathways in their brains, you know, and so it just sticks. It's the same thing with these predictions that the New York Times, of course, trumpets when, well, it's unprecedented warming of the ocean. And then when it's retracted, you know, it might end up on page A33 and nobody hears about it, unfortunately.
Yeah, and there's also this problem of selling a cultural agenda that we ought to be wary of.
Absolutely. Unfortunately, separating the worldview chaff from the empirical wheat, as you mentioned a minute ago, that's really important when it comes to any kind of environmental debate, because very often you're dealing with people that have fundamentally different views about what it means to be human. I mean, if you're a Christian, you believe, yeah, we can mess things up. We have to consume and we can despoil the earth and pollute it. But we're also creators of value. We're creatures made in the image of the creative God. And so we can be the problem, but we can also be the solution. But if you think, well, we're just basically parasites or cockroaches, and everything we do is bad. Anything we do to change the natural environment must be bad. Well, if you think that, pretty much anything we do to affect the environment is going to be treated as if it's some kind of violation of the law of nature. And so that's why you have some kind of radicals in the so-called deep ecology movement that really, I mean, their ideal would be a planet without any human impact at all. I'm not saying all environmentalists think this. That's certainly not true. But that is a dark strain, unfortunately, in the environmental movement. So you always have to sort of negotiate that. Okay, what does the evidence say? And more, is this really someone's axe to grind just against humanity in general?
Talk a little bit about the problem of having your eye on the wrong ball. What I mean by that, and this is something I've heard you discuss in the past, let's say climate change. If we spend tens of trillions of dollars of the global economy on the wrong problem, it has an attendant effect in that there are all kinds of other problems that don't get solved. Fresh water for everyone on the planet that doesn't presently have fresh water, for example.
That's right. I mean, that's just, you know, simple economics of opportunity costs is that if you do one thing, it's going to exclude you from doing something else. If we spend, say, you know, the Paris Climate Accords, which countries voluntarily sign on to where they pledge to try to reduce their use of carbon dioxide producing fuels for energy, let's say everybody does that. Well, the official estimates is that would cost about $1 to $2 trillion a year to the global economy. That's $1 or $2 trillion that's not being spent on something else, like economic development in the third world, where people, the most important thing that could happen to them is to increase their per capita income, because then they'll be more adaptable. Or as you said, fitting the rest of the world that doesn't have it with water sanitation equipment and technology. Most of those things would cost a fraction of the cost of these Paris climate protocols. And it turns out the official estimates from the UN is that even if all the countries actually signed on to the Paris Agreement, implemented it fully, it would have essentially a negligible effect on the warming of the planet between now and 2100. So it's a sort of all pain and no gain scenario, which doesn't make any logical sense.
I want to get back to the 12 reasons that you raise in terms of what we ought to question when it comes to the notion of consensus, whatever the subject. The second reason that I remember in your list of 12 is ad hominem attacks. And the one that I remember the most with respect to climate change was Alan Goodman of the Boston Globe, who said that we're at a point where global warming is impossible to deny. Let's just say that global warming deniers are now on par with Holocaust deniers. Now, there's a couple of things involved here. Part of the problem is the terminology that is used. I mean,
Yes. You're
not denying that the globe is warming.
No, not at all. Yeah, that's the problem. Of course, there's that. There's no denial of that. And then just the very use of the word denier, which is associated with Holocaust denial. And so they managed to tar you in two or three different ways simply by invoking that particular word. That's, unfortunately, I think that's the way this goes. We had a conference here at Catholic University a few years ago at the request of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. They just kind of wanted a briefing on the climate issue. And so I talked about the science, and there was another fellow that was on the panel who was also a believing Christian. And I kind of gave my 15-minute summary of the evidence. And then he did not respond to any of my scientific points. He just said that he knew that most people that took my position were really secretly funded by the oil industry and suspected that played some role in my views on this. Well, I have to say, I'd be happy to be funded by the oil industry if anyone wanted to send me a check. But it had nothing to do with that. And, of course, it was a mistake on his part, because he was at on a university campus with philosophers in the audience. And one of my colleagues said, wait, are you saying that Jay's views are determined by funding from oil companies? Is that really what you argued? But see, this is kind of reflexive, unfortunately, because people don't want to talk about the nuts and bolts. It's almost like if you get them talking about the science, they feel like you've gotten them off track. They assume that if you disagree with them, it must be the result of bad faith. It must be the result of some evil motive. You can't possibly just look at the evidence and come out differently on the interpretation.
So what about that? I mean, how do you get people to think critically? I was listening to some political debates, and you have people on either side throwing out these canards, and it's very, very hard, unless you have a critical thinking process in place, to figure out whether something that is being said really has any weight or it doesn't have any weight. And there's just so much nonsense that's being put into the stream, you hardly know where to begin if you don't know how to think critically.
No, that's the dilemma. And so I will very often, when I get these kind of ad hominem attacks and people want to sort of distract it, sometimes concede it. I'll say, okay, look, actually, I'd have never gotten any funding from any oil company, but let's assume that I have. That's still not going to change the logical point. If I'm saying whether something is happening and what's causing that thing to happen, that's a logical point. You don't have to trust me. Once you realize whether the Earth is warming and what's causing the Earth to warm, that's just a logical distinction that once it's pointed out, even if I'm a greedy guy that really wants to pull the wool over everybody's eyes, the point still stands. It's not like the cause of something and that something itself become the same because I'm being funded by the oil company. That's the problem. These ad hominem arguments very rarely they rarely bear on the issue at hand. And so you're constantly having to sort of appeal to people's kind of mother wit and common sense to see these things.
Well, you actually make a point of this, and I think it's your third point, where you talk about scientists who are pressured to toe the party line, which is huge with respect to tenure and job promotions, grants, media accolades, and, you know, vanity. All of these things are actually a factor.
No, they absolutely are. I mean, people, we have this mythological idea of the natural scientist as this sort of transcendent being that doesn't have any particular motives, that doesn't have any, is not susceptible to social pressure, that's just this totally objective being.
Sort of wearing a white lab coat.
Yes, always wearing a white lab coat and sort of floating above the fray. But scientists are human beings, and so the ideal of science is that you'd be objective and test the theory against the evidence. But in reality, scientists are just susceptible to groupthink. They're just as susceptible to attacking the person with an unpopular opinion as the rest of them.
We've run out of time for today's special edition of the Bible Answer Man broadcast. Be sure to tune in again tomorrow when we'll continue Hank Hanegraaff's conversation with philosopher and theologian J.W. Richards. If you'd like to stand shoulder to shoulder with Hank Hanegraaff and the Christian Research Institute in the battle for life and truth, and receive as our thanks for your gift Dr. Richards' book, The Human Advantage, The Future of American Work in an Age of Smart Machines, just call our resource consultants now at 888-7000-CRI, 888-7000-CRI, or go online to equip.org. That's equip.org. You can also write to us at CRI P.O. Box 8500, Charlotte, North Carolina, 28271. The Bible Answer Man broadcast is funded solely by listeners like you. We're on the air because life and truth matter. Anyone who's been paying attention knows there's a war going on, not just on traditional morality, civility, and decency, but even more fundamentally on historic notions of truth. And the enemy isn't just the onslaught of fake news facilitated by a post-truth culture and turbocharged by growing legions of ideological spin doctors. No, the real enemies of truth range from postmodernist convictions that there is no objective truth to militant scientism that claims that only science can determine truth, and religion is little more than primitive superstitions. But CRI support team members are not waving a white flag of surrender. They're holding the fort by undergirding every one of Christian Research Institute's mind-shaping and life-changing outreaches 24/7. To learn how you can make a difference and enjoy all the benefits of support team membership, simply visit equip.org.